union representatives, and so on. And you create the voting in a way that can have an effect. So you have like representation at the local level, a higher representation, and so on. And those union meetings come back into that category of elections. So the candidates must campaign at the union meetings themselves, and you get to hear what other people think of them and so on. None of that in the union I'm in now, and that makes it weak. That makes it unrepresentative. It doesn't live up to its potential. It sort of turns into a company union, turns into an association, or elements of that. Hasn't fully gone over that to that side yet, I don't think, but it's close in many ways. And many members don't have any connection, real connection to the union at all. They just see it come out of their paycheck, you know? And are all the members aware of that? No. They think this is what it is to be in a union. They think it's some sort of insurance scam. Oh, I pay money in, and then if I get in trouble or something, I can talk to that smiley-faced person that comes around every year, maybe, if I'm lucky, and I can talk to them about my problem or something. And that's what a union is. No. A union is about unity as much as possible around democratically decided policies to forward, improve the union, to be in solidarity with other unions, to if a member wants to be active, to be able to get active in a union, and the union to have a social component, and it to be social unionism, not business unionism. There's a lot of business unionism in the United States right now, throughout the history of the labor movement, versus social unionism, often led by socialists. And that is the choice that we face. So, in terms of my own personal union that I'm in, it's a bad situation. It's always better to have a union than not have a union. And, I look forward to it changing, but because of gerrymandering of elections, many positions not getting elected in the leadership, and the crucial lack of those membership meetings, the bureaucracy knows they can stay in power just about forever because they don't have the membership meetings to check them. To undermine them. And it's good to have bureaucracy undermined. Good to have leaders where they no longer represent the what people want to be undermined. And even if they do represent what people want, it's good to check them. It's good to be able to have, I have this democratic way of campaigning throughout the union at the membership meetings to get certain policies past the leadership, even if they don't like it. But that doesn't exist now in my union. And that may sound familiar to you in your union as well, but events are going to shake that up in some unions. Not making any predictions for sure, but in some unions, events will shake that up and have shaken that up. And look at the West Virginia teachers, which we're going to talk about in a minute. That's all. That whole explanation was about what a wildcat strike is. That's where the members go against the will of the leadership. And in West Virginia, twice they told the leaders, we don't agree, and they were strong enough to push through what they wanted. I look forward to a wildcat strike at Harvard University. I look forward to a wildcat movement within the union of the Harvard Union of Technical Workers and many other unions that they control or some other unions that they control. I look forward to wildcat strikes throughout the labor movement because the ossified bureaucracy that's stuck up the butt of the Democratic Party and stuck into capitalism and stuck into business unionism, they need to be removed like a cancer. They need to be removed, and wildcat action can be a part of that removal. Oh, by the way, this is WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio, Tufts Freeform Commercial Free Community-Based Radio, and you're listening to a little community slice of that radio. Socialist alternative radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. So I was getting into a public meeting hosted by Worcester Socialist Alternative. If you're out there or want to go out there to the middle of the state, there's only 40 minutes in good traffic from Boston. In bad traffic, all bets are off. And by commuter rail, it's about an hour. Should be a lot less than that. We'll save a special show for the irrationality and chaos of the United States lacking high-speed rail in a big way, which is one of the, you know, along with many, many other things people really need. Let's see, we're going to put on some Gil Scott-Heron. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we love Gil Scott-Heron. On this show. He's no longer with us, unfortunately. But, okay. So I was starting to read a little bit from this as a tease from this flyer, but I'll get to the point. It is at Clark University, This Tuesday, 7 p.m., this meeting from West Virginia to Worcester, teachers, workers, and student struggles. And it comes off the heels of a similar meeting at Worcester State University, where about a little over 50 people showed up with, including some unions from Worcester, which was great. A couple of unions from Worcester showed up. Or representatives from the unions, not the whole union, which is really the members of the union. And so what's going on here is Bryant William Skoulos, who is a PhD interdisciplinary political theorist, especially in modern and contemporary political theory, critical political economy, and global ethics, will be speaking. Bryant is currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Amherst Program in Critical Theory, an adjunct professor at Florida International University, and contributing writer for the Hampton Institute and Politics of Culture, section editor for Class, Race, and Corporate Power. I don't know if I read that right, but I tried. It's a bunch of things kind of glommed together there. Politics of Culture section editor for Class, Race, and Corporate Power. That's how you read it. In other words, a publication, Class, Race, and Corporate Power. His work has appeared in a variety of publications, including New Politics, Truth Out, Public Seminar, New Political Science, and Constellations. His newest work will be released in May 2018 alongside essays by David Harvey. David Harvey, by the way, is a famous Marxist geographer, and also Antonio Negri. And in a special edition, in a special issue of the Open Access Journal Communication, Capitalism, and Critique, marking the 200th birthday of Karl Marx. There you go. And by the way, what happened to the young Karl Marx film? Didn't make it. I didn't see it ever playing in Boston. We got to somehow get a copy of that, get a hold of that, get it shown in Worcester, get it shown in Boston. Yeah, anyway. So this meeting is this Tuesday, April 24th, 7 p.m., in a place called The Grind at Clark University. The Grind is in the Student Center near where people eat and stuff. It's a large room in a lower level. Look for The Grind in the Student Center at Clark University, GRIND, 7 p.m., Tuesday, April 24th. And this discussion is going to be interesting because it's going to be about West Virginia, but we're going to also make it local. And also even localized in terms of not just the struggles in Worcester, but the fact that Clark University in Worcester, a prominent, you know, well-known, but small, fairly small liberal arts college, is almost completely non-union, or pops completely non-union. And here we are where the Tufts University dining hall workers just organized successfully, or they're in the process. I think they're going to be successful. As you probably read, the Harvard Union, grad students have successfully voted in their union just within the past few days. They have to fight for a first contract. There's grad students and adjunct professors fighting around the country for union recognition. In the latest issue of Socialist Alternatives newspaper, there was a strike in Illinois that a member of Social Alternative was involved in, where Graduate Employees Organization, GE Local 6300, IFT, AFT, AFL-CIO, at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, did a strike against the University of Michigan and won. That was for 2,700 graduate students, and they started in 2017, I guess, that process. See, because when you get a union, the way to get a union in the United States is very difficult in some ways, but necessary to try anyway. You have to get either you have to force the company, and they're trying this in grad students at Brown are trying this, which I think is great. They are trying to force Brown University, to use an example, to recognize their union without going through the delays and the horrible things that the National Labor Relations Board often does to groups trying to organize unions. National Labor Relations Board will cut off parts of your group. Which they call a bargaining unit. They will delay things. They will make rulings that usually are not in your favor. I mean, some labor leaders would disagree with me on this. They see the NLRB and Taft-Hartley as a positive thing, and really, I think it's pretty easy to argue that it's a negative thing, that all sorts of rules, and it's just true with the West Virginia teacher strike, all sorts of rules are put on workers that are really just there to weaken unions. So you can try to get the company that you're fighting against in terms of unionizing to put enough pressure on them to accept the union without going through the National Labor Relations Board, which is a government agency. And then, or you go through the National Labor Relations Board, you get a certain number of cards signed, the board approves them. If it does, it can decide not to. And then you have the ability to hold an NLRB-sponsored election, which can be delayed, allowing management time to terrorize the workers in various ways to try to not have a union, or the grad students or whoever is organizing. Grad students or workers, in my opinion. So those are two ways to get that union, what we call an election of the union, just to have a vote to have the union in. And so that's for what just happened at Harvard, for example, or what's in the process of happening at Tufts with the dining hall workers, the Harvard grad students. And now, but that's not the end of it, unfortunately. Say you win the election, then you face challenges often from the corporations that go through an NLRB and delay things further. And this is very, very, very harmful for a grad students union or any workplace where there's a high turnover based on, you know, the nature of the work. Oh, strike that. Based on whatever is set up there by management. So in going for that first contract, management often loves delay. Not often, they just do. I'm sorry, I don't know why I'm qualifying things a certain way today. Management loves delay. They can sic the anti-union forces of the local media or the national media, corporate media, various astute and wonderful religious and business leaders will make, and liberals often will make their anti-union opinions known in the local op-ed of whatever, you know. And, you know, it'll just be an all-out attack against the union, trying to prevent the next step, which is negotiating a first contract. Now, according to national labor law, again, notice the double-edged sword here. Corporations, once that election has happened for the union to come in, for the union to exist, then a company must negotiate with the new union. Now, already, if you're paying attention, there's a problem. What's negotiate mean? Yeah. What does negotiate mean? Tends to mean very little for a lot of big businesses. So what a lot of businesses do is if they lose that vote and a union gets in, or small businesses, they will just bide their time. They'll pretend to negotiate, not really negotiate, and things will just stretch on and on and on and on. And the union can complain to the NLRB, the union can whatever, but unless it has the power to really go on strike, to force management, like the Illinois grad students did, to force management to the bargaining table to really negotiate, then there's big trouble. And it's hard to do that strike before have had a contract and have had time to consolidate your membership and so on in a big way. But it's not impossible. It has happened. It has to happen more and more. So it's that union election, which is subject to tons of terror tactics by management to stop people from voting for a union to begin with. And then getting that first contract negotiated where it's pretty much up in the air what negotiation means, and there's no time limit. One of the things that the Obama administration failed on completely, or let's get rid of the word failed, used in a disingenuous way, in a horrible way, a lying way to the labor movement, is they said, hey, labor movement, support us, you know, the Obama administration in 2012, through this thing called, because we'll support and we'll get past this thing called EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act, kind of an awkward name for something actually really, really important to unions, which included, among other things, the ability of putting a time frame on that first negotiation. If after 1 year, I believe it was, there's no first contract, then it goes automatically to mediation or arbitration towards a first contract. So essentially, you'd be guaranteeing a first contract. And then legal recognition included of a new union, whereas now you have legal recognition as a entity, but an entity without a first contract, there's no way in the United States terms to enforce anything the union wants. So management can try to make things really bad and really horrible and just terrorize again the workforce even after you've won the election, even after you've won the choice of having a union in that first in that period of negotiating the first contract. So what did the Obama administration do with EFCA? Nothing. They didn't even bring it up for a vote. There you go. Lesson number 5 trillion about how the Democrats are a party of big business, a party of the corporations. Left populism by someone like Obama is the equivalent in terms of its results as right populism by someone like Trump. Now, I'm not saying that what Obama did, what the Obama administration did, was as bad as what Trump is doing now, but it was bad enough, right? Those big bailouts to big corporations, the deporting more people than ever, you know, during the Obama administration, not helping people with evictions, not pushing through EFCA, you know, conducting the wars, the drone wars, and so on, after promising to get out of those wars, withdrawing somewhat, then moving back in. I mean, this is a whole list of what the Obama administration did. And it doesn't matter what you think about Obama, nice guy, you know, not a nice guy, whatever. It's what the administration did. It's what the Democratic Party did, Obama being part of that party, you know. And that is, that failure to even put forward EFCA in a serious way, because that could have had an educational effect, even if you put it forward and lost. But the Democrats, you have to remember, for the first 2 years of Obama's administration, controlled Congress the way the Republicans do now, completely. Same thing with the Clinton administration. You know, Billy Bob, or whatever his name was, Clinton, right? The president, the neoliberal president there, he, in the 90s, the Democratic Party controlled Congress for the first 2 years. They could have passed anything they wanted. Single-payer health care, could have got it passed. Boom. You name it. Wait a minute. That's under the assumption that the Democratic Party wants single-payer health care. They don't. They don't want that. They don't want that. And if we ever get single-payer from the Democrats, it's going to be single-payer that is crap. There's going to have to be a whole new movement to get decent universal health care. So anyway, let's get back to the meeting. Tuesday, April 24th, 7 p.m., The Grind, Clark University. And putting pressure, there's a lot of language here, putting pressure on people at Clark, or the Clark administration, to not fight unions as they do. There was an attempt to get a dining hall workers union a couple years ago. They managed to thwart that temporarily, hopefully. They recently, the administration at Clark refused to divest from fossil fuels. So anyways, it's an appeal to student organizations at Clark and others to get involved. Quote, drawing from the struggles such as the recent protests at Tufts University, where 500 students marched in solidarity with dining workers as they delivered a petition to unionize. Clark students must stand in solidarity with Clark workers. Their work environment is our learning environment. Many of us, grad and undergrads alike, are workers ourselves. In Social Alternative in Worcester, there are workers. There are grad students who are workers. There are undergrads who have to work. The West Virginia teacher strike points the way forward for labor, not just nationwide, but also at Clark. If workers, students, and community members can unite our struggle into a broader fight for demands like a $15 an hour minimum wage, improved Medicare for all, a free education center, we can win these gains and more. And I already mentioned Brian Skoulos, S-C-U-L-O-S, who will be speaking at the meeting. And the way we run those meetings, by the way, is, you know, the speakers actually have very little time, and it's really just mostly discussion. So I hope you will consider attending, or if you know people out in Worcester, ask them to attend. And in the latest issue of Socialist Alternatives newspaper, there's a Lessons of the West Virginia Teacher Strike. And we've talked about this on previous shows, but I really like this article. It's by Chuck Cannon, who's in Socialist Alternative. I think he was one of the people from Socialist Alternative that went out to West Virginia to help with the strike, to learn from the strike. And anyway, just a few excerpts, really. The article starts with, until they sign it, shut it down, chain of teachers from all 55 counties across West Virginia at a demonstration in the Capitol building on the 8th day of an illegal strike. I love that opening sentence, because it's two big things you should see that jump out at you. Wow. 55 counties, every county in West Virginia, that turns out, actually, all 55 counties, there were teachers from all of them out on strike. And actually, all of them were shut down. All school systems in all those counties were shut down. That's an amazing thing accomplished by the union. And this is the eighth day of their strike, and it's completely illegal. And they were called by the governor, who was a Democrat, who became a Republican, who's extremely wealthy. He's a billionaire coal baron. And like previous governors, he's given huge tax breaks to extractive industries such as coal and natural gas. And his administration has asked the working class of West Virginia to make sacrifices and accept austerity, while he owns millions in back taxes in West Virginia as well as Kentucky. That's a further along little snippet I wanted to read, but I'll bring it up here, because he called the teachers dumb bunnies and rednecks. Or I'm not sure he said rednecks, but right, another right-winger might have said that. And so the teachers showed up to the Capitol building wearing bunny ears and red bandanas, and they won a 5% raise for all public employees in a quote-unquote red state that only recently passed right-to-work laws that supposedly, you know, totally destroy unions, but they don't if the unions are strong enough. Of course, we don't want right-to-work laws. There's no need for them. We should have the opposite. We should have laws that, because right-to-work is a misnomer, we should have laws that, you know, help unions. So the teachers, like EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act, for example, or better laws than that, the teachers exposed the mass anger in society against the neoliberal agenda of cuts in education, healthcare, and social services, while handouts are given to the super rich and corporations. By the way, I'll just riff on that for a second. When we talk about, especially if you're not here, if you're listening to this show and you're not in the U.S., you have to understand that the economy right now is being considered by the corporate media as a booming economy with what do they call it? Full employment. That's a joke, because there's still millions of people unemployed, but they call it full employment because in some places the corporations are finding it hard, supposedly, to find the kind of workers they want to exploit. The reality for working people, though, is extremely different. Inequality is growing. Wages are still stagnant for the most part. And things can be really, really tough and are getting tougher for more and more people despite the so-called boom economy. What the so-called boom economy might do for some workers is make it easier to find a job. But in the way they have to pay for everything as a worker now, finding an extra job means even less time than you already have, which is very little probably, with your family. It means added transportation costs. It means a lot of things. You end up making a lot less than you think you are by getting that second job. And things are right now, if you try to keep up with the sort of cutting edge of the economy, so to speak, the way it's developing, you have, for example, a rapidly increasing gasoline prices and oil prices, and behind that, and that cuts into all many, many factors of consuming necessary consumption that working people make. But also, something that the corporate media hasn't started talking about yet, and they probably will, you're going to see inflation probably kick up, because oil goes into the productive processes of so many different, productive processes, so many different factories, so many different transportation systems. Oil is a key thing. And that will increase, if the price of oil goes up, the companies will try to offload that cost onto working people. And that's already happening with the gas prices, but they'll try it in, like, you know, plastics manufacturing. They'll try it in transporting food, you know, or transportation costs are going up, so the cost of lettuce is going up and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just going to really, if this continues, from what I've been reading, it will, then you're going to see all of a sudden talk about inflation again, which they're going to blame on workers, because, you know, there's been some recent, in some sectors, little uptick in wages versus the stagnation that's usually happening for the last 30 years or whatever, or the downturn in wages. This isn't really affecting workers that much. To get a 2% raise now doesn't mean a hell of a lot, because you're trying to catch up through previous cycles of inflation, however low it still was there, that it just sent you back, you know, especially in certain things. Like they like to say now inflation is relatively low. Well, they control how that statistic is gathered. If you're someone that has children wanting to go to college, then inflation is extremely high. And there's a $4 trillion college loan debt out there of people trying desperately to afford college, to just go to college, get through it. And that's getting worse, right? So I'm not just trying to say that economic prosperity is relative, which it certainly is, meaning workers don't have it, and the big big corporations are getting tax breaks and the super rich are getting tax breaks, and then not refusing to cough up any of that money, saying there's no money there. So we're still in like this period. This was my main point. I should have got to a lot sooner. Main point is that you have a, you know, the corporate media trumpeting a, no pun intended, trumpeting a booming economy. And they'll make nods to like the fact that there might be underlying problems and stuff. But, you know, in general, they call it a, full employment economy, booming economy, and all these misnomers as far as what's actually happening on the ground for working people. But then they say there's no money for schools. There's no money for, like I said earlier in the show, bus transit in Worcester, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, this was a really big big deal. The West Virginia teacher strike, you probably heard of. They were in a desperate situation. They're in a state that voted for Trump overwhelmingly. 68% voted for Trump. And so there, you know, this cuts, as the article gets into it, I don't have time to get into it, cuts into the whole myth of, someone, a vote, an election is just a snapshot. How people really feel, given the extremely limited choices in corporate politics in America, you cannot extrapolate too far based on that election. It does mean something, obviously, but in West Virginia, their teachers were able to overcome that, not just in their own ranks, because they included other unions. See, the two teachers' unions brought along other unions with them and non-union workers out on strike, believe it or not. Or they brought yes, they did, and also there, in terms of preparing for the strike, they included many others. There were real attempts, which the article goes into really well, of the Democratic Party channeling all this into non-guaranteed agreements twice during the strike, and their union leaders going along with that, and that's where it became a wildcat strike, where the workers just said, no, we don't think that is, and it might have been a wildcat strike before that in terms of going on strike, I'm not clear on that, but in terms of once out on strike, when they were told to go back to work, the teachers, by their union leaders, and the Democrats were behind this, the teachers said, no, we have no guarantee of the 5%. In fact, they were saying at the time, the Democrats wanted them to take a 3% raise to other public employees. The teachers refused, which was great solidarity by them. And by the way, the illegal part of the strike, because it was so strong, even the Republican governor, who used to be a Democrat, by the way, didn't bother to try to like round them all up, you know, like there's a lot of unjust laws out on the books that can be defeated immediately by enough people breaking the laws together. That's extremely important to do. There are plenty of anti-union laws out there. For example, laws against teachers going on strike and public sector workers going on strike. And periodically those laws are broken successfully because they have to be. Because if you're a worker, you have to be able to have some control. You have to make some control over your own labor. It's the main power you have with other workers, not alone. And this really shows, because the Democrats and the Republicans were at times fighting for the same end to the strike, and the Democrats pushing just for the November election for themselves, that it showed, and some teachers, of course, bought into that, you know, they had a slogan, in November we'll remember, meaning they're going to do the ping pong game, and this time, you know, hit Democrat instead of Republican when they get to the machine or whatever. But a lot of teachers said they neither trusted neither Democrats or Republicans nor the union leadership to give them a victory, and they held out. And they had a huge solidarity thing going on. A strike fund. They raised $320,000 plus online for a strike fund. They used money they raised to provide meals for students when they were on strike. There were socialist alternative members from Pittsburgh, Columbus, Philadelphia, and Seattle that traveled to West Virginia, had many conversations. And here's a good quote. Teachers were more than happy to talk to us, even though there was some suspicion of socialism at first, but once we established that we were there to listen and support their struggle, they are actually excited to speak with open socialists. There were other socialists involved in the strike, probably not as open as we were, or not open at all, and they played some of them played a good role behind the scenes, but we encourage socialists to be open about their politics. I could give you many examples of where that is a plus, not at all a negative. The West Virginia strike was led in part by radical women in the rank and file. The role of women in general cannot be understated. There was a huge, it's predominantly a female workforce in the teachers. And teachers and nurses nationwide have been the most militant union workers lately in the United States. And it's no accident, this article contends, that with all the reaction of the big women's rallies and the Me Too movement against Trump and against sexism in general and repression against women have played a factor in the militancy of the teachers. There are other examples besides West Virginia. Chicago teachers in 2012, Seattle teachers in 2015 had victories. As you probably know, if you're paying attention to the media, strikes or post-strike victories are unfolding in Arizona, in Oklahoma, in Kentucky. Next shows we'll come in more with that information in a more detailed way, what happened or what's going on in Kentucky, Arizona, Oklahoma. And I think I mentioned some of that in previous last show, but I don't have that memorized, unfortunately. So the remaining time we have, which is not much, I'd hope to get more into this. As promised, we're going to get more into Earth Day. And today is Earth Day, April 22nd. And as I said earlier, I used an example of what I heard on the way into the show today. But, Earth Day has been sort of like Martin Luther King Day, in a rough analogy, has been, made into something, very not radical, not profound, not really anything, but, the sort of liberal charitable impulse. Like, what are people doing for Earth Day? Such group is cleaning up the Charles River next week or whatever. And that's fine. I'm really into that kind of cleanup stuff, right? But that's really not, that should be like a little part of Earth Day, right? Earth Day is not about personal charitable impulses or personal cleaning or personal green anything. Earth Day is about massive protests. That's what it was born in, to highlight, to educate people about problems, severe, even existential problems with the environment and the human impact on the environment and what that means for human life and other species' lives as we go forward. So it's all about protesting big polluters, big corporations, and it's about protesting the system. The best environmentalists have been anti-capitalists. There's a huge number, a huge trend, I won't say number, but a huge sort of representation within the environmental movement. I'll take back huge. I'll say there's a significant representation of people that are clear on the concept that you cannot clean up the environment or even stop environmental crises like climate change and global warming through capitalism. So they're decidedly anti-capitalist. Whether or not they're socialists, some are. For example, James Bellamy Foster of Monthly Review, a magazine, a socialist magazine. Has written a lot about the environment. Mike Davis, who writes for different publications, is an activist as well. He's had a sort of an environmental angle on a lot of the stuff he writes. Not everything, but a lot of it. For a socialist, a good socialist, I'd say, or a decent one, a well-rounded one, the environmental movement is part and parcel of the socialist movement. There's no separating it. Now, does that mean that socialists are running the environmental movement, leading it right now? No, in most places not. And that's a big problem. Liberals are. Single-issue liberals. They're going to work on this issue or that issue, or they have a holistic approach to the environment, but they don't include workers' rights in there. They don't have a way of overcoming the wonderful contradiction capitalists love so much of jobs, we'll use the headline, jobs versus the environment. If you convince people that their immediate life is in living standard is in danger and even ability to survive is in danger by cleaning up the environment or taking action against environmental poisoning, against the environment being poisoned by capitalism, plenty of workers are going to refuse to immediately take steps that could endanger their own jobs and their own families, and that's perfectly understandable. What socialists bring to the table in that situation is a an equal, if not more so, fight for those workers' rights. So if they're in a polluting industry that needs to be shut down, like nuclear power, for example, then those workers should get full pay benefits and fully paid retraining until they find comparable, meaning in terms of wages and benefits, work. So that's a lot of money that's got to go into making sure those workers feel confident enough to participate in the shutdown of their industry, to be part of the movement, environmental movement. And I'd say a ton of environmentalists don't even think about that stuff. I mean, I've had the example. I've always been interested in environmentalism and ecology and so on. I almost majored in ecology in college. And I went back in my day, you know, anti-nuclear power protests, and I would talk to the Clamshell Alliance people here in the Boston area, some of them. I'm not saying they all were like this, but some were, definitely. And other environmental groups, I've run into this. Green Party, I've run into this to a certain extent. But again, I'm not trying to make a huge generalization. I'm sure people thought this through a little bit, other people. But what I would often get, most often actually, is this personal moral responsibility thing, and not a systemic critique plus a way to make people be able to survive the wrenching deep-seated changes that need to happen in the economy to transition basically to a socialist economy, but even under capitalism, to transition in a sustainable way or more sustainable way as we try to really get to sustainability through socialism. So that would mean, for example, what I mean concretely is I had, for example, a relative working in a nuclear power plant in a union job, you know, just not running the place or anything, but just, you know, as a worker. And that job was actually a step up. That person was risking their lives working in that plant because the money, because it was a union job, was much better than what they're making before. And they came from a situation where they were on food stamps, all right? So they came from a situation where they were without work and on food stamps and didn't know what was going to happen next, and then got that job. Right? And that job was the highest paid job they'd ever had. They stuck in that job for, I don't know, 20 some years or whatever, because that's what you got to do when you're working. You got to take care of your family. You got to take care of yourself. And so that means logging. You know, you're not the one making the laws about clear cutting, right? If you're a worker, you know, if you're a worker at a nuclear power plant, you're not the one that set that crappy, polluting, deadly thing up of nuclear power, but you got to make a living. And of course, we all go through, every worker has to make those horrible decisions and do something they know they're not contributing. Like when I got a job at Harvard University, after many other types of jobs and so on, blue collar, white collar, whatever, I get a job at Harvard University, I had a little thought to myself, at least, you know, I'm working in a library system and I'm not contributing to like nuclear power proliferation or, you know, the military, or, you know, I had all these things listed off in my head. This is when I was younger, that I'm not contributing to by having this, you know, little job in a library, right? And I quickly learned that I was deluding myself. I was fooling myself. Harvard University is the richest university in the world. It's a corporation. It's not a nonprofit, like even though it has nonprofit tax status. It has investments in big businesses, in oil, in things that pollute, in real estate, things that make people homeless. It's got all these types of investments, sucking in tons of money, rich people donating money to that instead of something else, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's a monster, a capitalist monster. And my little part in keeping that capitalist monster running is not objectively a good thing, but I'm not a moralist because I don't believe in this get off the grid and lead a pure life. That's for religious people. I'm a socialist, you know. We have to do, and under capitalism, we have to do the jobs that the capitalists create for their own profit, by and large, to survive, so we can survive. And only when we gain control of the ability to plan work and to plan jobs can we then say, create moral work, right? Until then, you know, when we can identify work that is polluting and we want to transition to non-polluting work, then we have to fight, and most people aren't fighting for this because their leaders aren't fighting for it. We have to fight to make sure the workers are taken care of. Otherwise, you create literally millions of workers who say, oh yeah, I had a job, and they shut it down because it was polluting too much. But I'll take the job over the shutting down because of pollution, because I need a job, you know? And that's a devil's bargain. That's a Faustian bargain or whatever they call it, a Hobson's choice, blah, blah, blah. Workers are faced with those choices where there's no choice. It's like lesser evilism, Democrat or Republican. There's no choice there. There's no real choice in terms of what's beneficial to us. There's no choice. We're going to get screwed either way, right? And we know that. Some of us know that. A lot of us know that. More of us, on and on, are knowing that. We're becoming socialists to fight against that. But I'm not going to tell somebody that works in the polluting industry, quit your job as an individual, because I won't do anything. They'll just hire another person in that job. And I'll say, but I will say to that person, hey, we've got a movement going. We're going to shut that. We're going to try to shut that down. But you're going to get, we're going to fight for you to get full pay, full benefits, full retraining on pay until you get a comparable job. And if I can show that person that I'm part of a viable movement to do that, then I will say, join this movement. I won't say quit your job. I'll say join this movement, and we're going to organize this. Now, the environmental movement doesn't take that up. You know, I'll get a million, Greenpeace will spend $1 billion on propaganda about plastics or something, which is fine, because I, in a certain way, I mean, that's necessary. But to rail against plastics, I mean. But some of that money should be going to programs that will help workers, right, in a real profound, obvious, concrete way to not have to make the choice between jobs and the environment, you know? Greenpeace should be fighting for public works programs, for example, you know, under union control, and that would be unionized and have union benefits and so on. Anyway, what I'm leading up to here is a really good article, and I've read other articles like this before, and I've talked about them. Like, for example, Derek Jensen had an article in Orion magazine. Now it's been a bunch of years, but it was called Why Shorter Showers Aren't the Answer or something like that. Derek Jensen, a Texas-based journalist and teacher and professor. And he gave a very quick, short article, but very profound article about why your individual consumption habits, whether they be green or not, are not the problem. That the problem is systemic pollution. So here on Earth Day, I'm going to talk about this article by Martin Lukacs, L-U-K-A-C-S, from something called True North. I believe it's a British publication. Neoliberalism has conned us into fighting climate change as individuals. I would substitute the word neoliberalism to capitalism. And later in the article, he does make a point that I kept thinking to myself as I'm reading the article, that this is nothing new. And he does acknowledge that later in the article. I wish he had like said that right up front. Here we go. Even before the advent of neoliberalism, the capitalist economy had thrived on people believing that being afflicted by the structural problems of an exploitative system, poverty, joblessness, poor health, lack of fulfillment, was in fact a personal deficiency. So just the same way that now it's a personal deficiency that's causing these huge problems of pollution, like plastic pollution or radiation pollution from Fukushima or whatever, the pollution from fossil fuel burning and global warming and climate change extremes and so on. So the article is from last year, July 2017, from True North, Martin Lukacs. Would you advise someone to flap towels in a burning house, meaning like try to put out a fire with that, to bring a fly swatter to a gunfight? Yet the council we hear on climate change could scarcely be more out of sync with the nature of the crisis. And they have a picture of some aristocrat in Britain urging the public to recycle. So, you know, it's obviously, if you think about the way the article is and the way I'm trying to put forward, that's absurd, ridiculous, and very ironic. Anyway, the email in my, this is back to Martin Lukacs, the email in my inbox last week offered 30 suggestions to green my office space. Use reusable pens, redecorate with light colors, stop using the elevator. And by the way, I get a lot of that stuff too. Back at home, quoting again the article, done huffing upstairs, I could get on with other options. Change my light bulbs, buy local veggies, purchase eco-friendly appliances, put a solar panel on my roof. And a study released on Thursday claimed it had figured out the single best way to fight climate change. I could swear off ever having a child. So here we have some environmentalists saying that human life itself is the problem. And they do that with a straight face. I disagree vehemently as a socialist. it's the overpopulation is not a problem. I mean, he doesn't make that argument at all in here. I'm just riffing on this. Overpopulation is not a problem really in this planet. It's the way resources are allocated, and it's the way that resources are made. And it's got nothing to do with overpopulation. And we'll talk about that more some other time. But right now, I'll get back to this main point on Earth Day 2018. These pervasive exhortations to individual action in corporate ads, in school textbooks, and the campaigns of mainstream environmental groups, especially in the West, seem as natural as the air we breathe. But we could hardly be worse served. While we busy ourselves greening our personal lives, fossil fuel corporations are rendering these efforts irrelevant. The breakdown of carbon emissions since 1988 is that 100 companies alone are responsible for an astonishing 71% of carbon emissions. So you tinker with those pens or that solar panel while they go on torching the planet. And I saw some interesting stats recently. I don't have them with me today, but oil production is at record levels worldwide. You know, coal production, record levels. While a lot of people, I think, they think that those industries are being sort of retooled somehow, they're not. They're not being retooled. Because even if the corporations can't sell in some of the advanced capitalist countries that are using more alternative sources of power, which is good, there's other markets, the underdeveloped world, they will force these fossil fuels onto. And just by their time, to start saying, to get someone like Trump in power and actually redouble their efforts to drill and mine and force the use of coal and oil. The freedom of these big corporations to pollute and the fixation on a feeble lifestyle response is no accident. It is the result of an ideological war waged over the last 40 years, I would say longer than that, but we'll stay here, last 40 years against the possibility of collective action. Devastatingly successful, but it is not too late to reverse it. The political project of neoliberalism brought to a sentence by Thatcher and Reagan, again, I would go further back to Carter and others, has pursued two principal objectives. The first has been to dismantle any barriers to the exercise of unaccountable private power. The second has been to erect these barriers against the exercise of any democratic public will. Kind of the same thing, but whatever. In trademark policies of privatization, deregulation, tax cuts, and free trade deals, these things have liberated corporations to accumulate enormous profits and treat the atmosphere like a sewage dump and hamstring our ability through the instrument of the state to plan for our collective welfare. Anything resembling a collective check on corporate power has become a target of the elite. Lobbying and corporate donations, hollowing out democracies, have obstructed green policies and kept fossil fuel subsidies flowing. And the rights of associations like unions organizing, or unions, the most effective means for workers to wield power, I would add workers' parties, socialist parties and so on, if they're real, not the corrupted ones, are not the ones that have become pro-capitalist. That was a little addition by me. Together have been undercut whenever possible. At the very moment when climate change demands, an unprecedented collective public response, neoliberal ideology stands in the way, which is why, if we want to bring down emissions fast, we'll need to overcome all of the free market mantras. Take railways and utilities and energy grids back into public control. Regulate corporations to phase out fossil fuels. Raise taxes to pay for massive investment in climate-ready infrastructure and renewable energy. Now, when he says raise taxes, I say don't raise taxes on working people. And that's what Social Alternative says. But raise taxes on the super rich or the big corporations. Maybe he's implying that, but that was a poor phrase in my opinion. But anyways, for massive investment in climate-ready infrastructure and renewable energy so that solar panels can go on everyone's rooftop, not just those who can afford it. Neoliberalism has not merely ensured this agenda is politically unrealistic. It has also tried to make it culturally unthinkable. Its celebration of competitive self-interest and hyper-individualism, its stigmatization of compassion and solidarity, has frayed our collective bonds. It has spread like an insidious antisocial toxin. For example, what Margaret Thatcher preached, there is no such thing as society. Studies show that people who have grown up under this era have indeed become more individualistic and consumerist, steeped in a culture telling us to think of ourselves as consumers instead of citizens, as self-reliant instead of interdependent. Is it any wonder we deal with a systemic issue by turning in droves to ineffectual individual efforts? We are all Thatcher's children. Now again, I'd say there's a countervailing tendency of actually, especially millennials and younger people, protesting more, not, probably not buying into some of what he's talking about. And of course, it predated Thatcher. And of course, it's still there. So I think it's a fight, sort of part of the class war, basically. How you see the environment and changing the environment, changing the economy so the production of what people need can be sustainable and save the environment for human habitation and many other species as well. Even before the advent of neoliberalism, the capitalist economy, and here's the part that I read earlier, which I really like, he's basically saying this happened before neoliberalism. Now, just another couple of quick quotes. Neoliberalism has taken this internalized self-blame and turbocharged it. It tells you that you should not merely feel guilt and shame if you can't secure a good job or are deep in debt or are too stressed for overworked for time with friends. You are now responsible for bearing the burden of potential ecological collapse. And, you know, that could be used as an analogy to so many things, so many social problems, whether it's racism or environmental destruction or poverty, where we're taught that the people are responsible. You know, a group of people, all white people are this, all poor people are this, all whatever. Or in racist terms, all... You know, Trump's obvious racism against Mexicans or whatever, or police attitudes towards black people and so on. There are room for generalizations if they're based on some sort of reality, right? But the generalizations used as far as blaming societal problems on anything but the system are absurd. Since when do we vote on how corporations decide to exploit labor and natural resources, which is what they do as part of capitalism? When do we vote on that? When do we vote on how corporations use financial, instruments and games and, credit-based schemes to make money, seemingly above the production that creates that money and so on, creates that value? It's not really divorced from it, but they use it to increase their wealth enormously. We don't vote on that. The best you could say is that we indirectly vote on the choices of the capitalists politically through the two corporate parties, the Republicans, and then they might pass some legislation that might affect one little aspect of how banks, for example, are allowed to, you know, like the Glass-Steagall Act being passed and then recently taken down and collapsed and not being used anymore legally, all very legally. Of course, we need people to consume less and innovate low carbon alternatives, build sustainable farms, invent battery storages, spread zero waste methods. But individual choices will count most when the economic system can provide viable environmental options for everyone, not just for an affluent or intrepid few. So, if you ever run into a hardcore off-the-grid type, you know, they'll have a lot of arguments for that. And basically, they're wrong. A lot of the stuff they're using is very much from the grid and very much something they did not produce. But variations of that, of the individualistic solutions to problems that are caused really by big corporations and by the military and that kind of level of waste and pollution is, it just dwarfs, really just makes tiny the individual excesses that some people might have in consumption. If affordable mass transit isn't available, people will commute with cars. I'm an example of that. If local organic food is too expensive, they won't opt out of fossil fuel intensive supermarket chains. Unfortunately, I try to buy organic, it gets to be too much. And in fact, me and my wife kind of compete on this. She likes to buy inorganic stuff. I'm trying to buy organic. You know, we're both right and we're both wrong because it's a system. If cheap mass-produced goods flow endlessly, yes, consumers will buy and buy and buy. This is the con job of neoliberalism, to persuade us to address climate change through our pocketbooks rather than through power and politics. Eco-consumerism may expiate your guilt, your individual guilt, but it's only mass movements, mass political movements that have the power to alter the trajectory of the climate crisis. This requires of us, first, a resolute mental break from the spell cast by neoliberalism to stop thinking like individuals. The good news is that the impulse of humans to come together is inextinguishable, and the collective imagination is already making a political comeback. The climate justice movement is blocking pipelines, forcing the divestment of trillions of dollars, and winning support for 100% clean energy economies in cities and states across the world. New ties are being drawn to Black Lives Matter, immigrant and indigenous rights, and fights for better wages. On the heels of such movements, political parties seem finally ready to defy neoliberal dogma. Okay, what does he mean by that? Well, he comes up with one example. Corbyn and the Labour Manifesto spelled out a redistributive project to address climate change by publicly retooling the economy and insisting the corporate oligarchs no longer run amok. The notion that the rich should pay their fair share to fund this transformation was considered laughable by the political and media class. Millions disagreed. Society, long said to be departed, but you know, by Thatcher's quote, famous quote, for example, is now back with a vengeance. Society is back with a vengeance. So grow some carrots and jump on a bike. It will make you happier and healthier, but it is time to stop obsessing with how personally green we live and start collectively taking on corporate power. So that article has its limitations, like you know, nothing about how it would take socialism to have the international democratic planning necessary of the economy to really stop the crisis, the economic crisis we're facing. And if we'd had more time, I was going to get into that more, and maybe next time. But there is also the sorry, I'm just shuffling papers here stupidly. The there's also the problem with the article that the political examples they came up with of Corbyn has a long way to go, and Labour Party unfortunately has a long way to go, and a lot's happening. I don't have time to go into too much, but you know, there's a right wing to the Labour Party in Britain that is trying to stop the reconquering the Labour Party by this left wing. And even the left wing, under Corbyn and Momentum and so on, they make a lot of mistakes, and they support a lot of things that aren't worthy of support of a truly left party. And elsewhere in Europe, there's been the left parties have been, yes, there have been some growing and getting more votes, but some of the victories recently, especially the ones the corporate media will focus on, have been right-wing parties. Sort of like the what's, you know, in a rough way, the right-wing populism of Trump is, of course, not, has never has been just Trump. It's an old trick under capitalism. So whether it's liberal populism, which offers no solutions, or right-wing populism, which offers no solutions, there are times, usually what's happening is that the mass movements and or electoral movements generated by the working class through unions, political parties, big movements around issues and community groups and so on, or even environmental movements, the original Earth Day, these are the exceptions rather than the rule under capitalism. It takes time and effort. Nothing is spontaneous. One of the things in that West Virginia teachers article I could have focused on is how the strike, despite its the wildcat nature of it, despite its illegality, and so on, did not make it a spontaneous effort. It was there were stages in the building of it and in the planning of it. So we're out of time, but it's been good and gone by fast, too fast, because there was so much to talk about. And we'll be back in a couple weeks. You've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. For more information, go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. And Socialist Alternative Radio is talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. Check out socialistalternative.org on the web for more information about how to get involved, because we hope you can use some of the information that you heard today, but also that you will go out and try to act on it. And I don't mean, you know, do the cleanup of the Charles River and the green stuff in this like sort of low-key liberal thing. That can't, you know, it's okay, right? But put the vast majority of your effort in getting out and protesting, occupying, blockading these polluting industries, the pipelines and so on, which is already actually happening in a big way and needs to get bigger, and link it with workers' issues that so people don't have to make the choice between jobs and the environment, that we can have jobs, decent paying jobs, you know, and a sustainable environment, at least be heading in that direction, not only here, but on a world scale. So thanks for listening, and we'll take you out with some, take you out. Is that a decent phrase? No. We will go out with, maybe this will blow you away, this song. We'll go out with Gil Scott-Heron, and then if we have time, Imagine by by John Lennon, which we play often on the show because we like the lyrics so much. Gil Scott Heron's song, I got stuff to double check here. That's going to be Save the Children. Try that. Oh, sorry for the silence. Here we go. Gil Scott Heron. Wrong. There we go. Enjoy.